Hey TSLers, producer Jeff here, first reminding you that this is actually part two of a two-part conversation that we had with the creators of the Oscar-nominated short film War Is Over. So, if you haven't listened to part one, I would jump back and listen to that now. It aired yesterday. And before we jump in, I actually wanted to ask you all for a quick favor. Longtime fans of the show know that I wrote and directed a feature that premiered on Apple and Amazon last year to rent or buy, but for the first time, you can actually watch my movie Always Lola for free. It premiered on Tubi today. Thank you, Tom. And the way that Tubi works is actually if we can catch a certain number of baseline viewers in the next 3 or 4 days, we unlock this new recommendation algorithm, which makes a huge, huge difference for the movie. So it's a really quick and easy way to help me, and it actually has a huge impact on the future of the film. There's never been a lower barrier of entry to check out the movie, so I'd love for you to watch it. I'm proud of it. But literally, even if you just click the link and let it stream in the background on your phone or smart TV, it's a huge help for us. But it's even better if you click thumbs up or add to my list. So I'd love for you to do that. I will link the movie in the description below. And if you do watch it and check it out, DM me and I'll talk about it with you. All right. I hope you guys enjoy part two of our conversation with the team from War Is Over.
Now, in my experience as a writer, I'm still there as it's gone going into boards, and we, you know, like you said, 6 months, and we get this, and then it blows up, and we go back, right? And we, what we learn from the boards and that screening, we redo the whole story many, many times. So, what is that process like for you in this process? I understand that there were some boards, but how does it affect the storytelling and the development of the story? Now, you were on a short, so maybe you had that pretty locked down when you went in. If you were doing a feature this way, would you really want to lock that script, or is it going to be the same process?
Yeah, I think we want to have a really locked script where we know what we're doing and we're not just experimenting on stage. We don't want to do that. Like, I think films would benefit from having scripts that are locked out and not, you know, not moving too fast, giving the writers time to work it out. And that goes back to the idea that, like, let's stay small for a long time, you know, for longer so that we can get it right and then move rationally into expanding the size of the crew. And that's why we want to do this with fewer people.
This is some story blasphemy, Dave Mullins, story blasphemy. I have to say.
As a writer, because, of course, I'm like, oh, give the rest of the time.
I have a little different view on that I'd like to interject.
For 10 years at Pixar, that is 100% the opposite of my experience. Not that I'm advocating for one way or another, but like the iteration process is how we would discover so many things.
And that's like, my point. I believe this methodology, I think it may, look, you always want to start with the best script you possibly can, Meg. I really believe that. But I think what this process does is it invites you in along the way. If, you know, and I know as a writer, you guys are scheduled on this film and then you move on to this film and you have to go back and do rewrites on the next film. But in perfect, you know, filmmaking land, if it were, you guys would be part of the process alongside.
It would be amazing. It would be amazing to, as the writer, to be, have a script that I'm not going to say is locked, but you've had time, all of us, let's say, to work on it. And then you get to go on the stage and be there. For when the times when I was in edit and Pixar were the best, because right there in edit, they would go, what are we doing right now? And
exactly.
I'd be like, what about this? And
but imagine that editorial process you're talking about being on the stage while we're shooting stuff. And like you
pick
could
me.
Literally
pick
be.
Me. I would love
I've
to do
done
that.
It.
I mean,
it is phenomenal. It is exciting. It's like in real time and you like see the cut right there on the stage and then be like, okay, we're going to go back in and let's try this.
John, were you able to be there?
Yeah.
I really regret that I missed most of the performance
stuff.
But I did get to see Avatar 3 getting shot. We went to the same stage where they were working. And honestly, because I'm not a filmmaker, especially I've never worked in CGI and animation, I had so many things to understand conceptually about the process and the fact that, I mean, because I think I do understand a lot more about the traditional animation process. I've made, like, you know, kind of student filmy animations on my own before, like hand-drawn stuff. But there was a lot to really conceptually understand. So I actually don't, I'm glad I wasn't there because I feel like I would have misunderstood what was happening because it took me a while to make that conceptual leap. Part of it was actually going to the Jim Cameron stage and checking out how they worked. And I realized, and then looking at our finished film in my mind and thinking, oh, like, and kind of connecting the dots, literally. I mean, it's dots on these jumpsuits. But I didn't realize the degree to which the data is so malleable. But once I had that epiphany, it's like, oh wait, like what they're shooting, because Brad kept saying like, oh, it allows you to be more flexible. I'm like, well, why though? Because you have to have physical people in a room, and it seemed like you were locking into reality more than with a pencil, right? But then I realized, oh, but it's just data. It's like with music. When I made the connection to all the innovations that we've had musically in terms of recording, I realized that it's very similar in terms of allowing you to basically have like a God's eye view, like an omniscient view of the music. You can tune anything after the fact. You can pitch things after the fact. You can change, you know, the tempo after you've recorded a live band and not change the key. The amount of malleability is amazing. And with the visual stuff, I didn't realize it's like, okay. And what Dave was talking about, even the first time he told me that story, I didn't really know what he meant. But now I realize what he's saying is like, basically you can do a panning with your hands with the camera that is set to the proportions of if you were, you know, that would make it the equivalent of being a helicopter that flies up 100 miles into the air, because exactly. You're just like, you've filmed the dots, basically the data, these 3D dots that are the people's skeletal forms, and you can shrink one of them, make one of them a giant. You can make everybody the size of an ant compared to whatever you're shooting. I mean, you can do anything you want, or you can shoot 12 people and get rid of like 4 of the performances and keep the rest. Or you can even mix and match different shots. Like if you shoot 12 people 5 times, you can pick person 11 for take 3 and person 12 for take 4. So, I mean, that's just wild to me. I didn't even understand that was the advantage of it. So anyway, so yes, this was an exciting thing for me to learn, because I love learning about filmmaking. And it really took me a while to realize what Brad and Dave were talking about in terms of we're doing things differently, because I'd never done it the way they did in the old days with Pixar.
Right. Okay. I mean, so I have a question. Yeah. And I'm sure that when it went from hand-drawn to computer animation at all, this was also a question. So I realize it's an ancient question that I'm asking. I do think that things are, do you worry as artists and Brad, I include you in that. I believe producing is an art. As artists, do you worry that it gets too perfect? Do you that part of art is the mistake, yeah, is the flaw in, yeah, the, sure, in the weave?
Well, I know what you're talking about. I think about this all the time because I'm a music producer, and I will say that, you know, it's always been a potential problem for anyone who gets too good at anything. I mean, you can look at certain guitar players who are absolutely technically better than Jimi Hendrix. But are they better than Jimi Hendrix? Would you rather listen to them than Jimi Hendrix? No. So The point of being an artist is understanding, especially if you're a producer or a director, you have to understand what makes art great. And And if you think perfecting every little aspect of everything is what makes it great, then you're not a great artist. Maybe that's good for architecture or something if you're dealing with like safety regulations. But I think what makes a great artist is taste first, because, you know, you look at someone like Lou Reed, you know, he didn't play guitar very well, but he couldn't even sing very well by any regular standard. But he's an amazing artist, and he's much better than, I don't want to name people I don't like, but people who have incredible technical ability, but you just don't want to listen to their music because it's too manicured. I think that's always been a problem in art. And, you know, I think taste is what saves you from that, is knowing what to leave in. And I think Dave is, you know, he's a real artist. These guys are real artists. They are.
And that's what I love about the film.
They know exactly. And they know when to not go too far.
That's why I kind of wanted to talk about that, you know, because we redid our third act after we shot everything. So I think that I probably used the wrong words by saying locked. What I meant by the script, I think I'm going all the way back in 10 minutes because I'm a tricky guy.
Backpedaling. You're like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
No, but I just want to clarify. I don't want to redact. I want to clarify. You want to have the best version of the script possible when you go on stage is what I meant. I shouldn't have said locked. You guys are right. And we did. We had the best version of the screenplay.
Locked is an animation term that we use as a gate. And not necessarily as a final, right? As you lock it for each department.
That's how I was referring to it.
To me, right? You lock it and it's locked in air quotes, a story, and it moves down the pipeline, but it doesn't mean it doesn't come back. So
exactly. That's how I was referring to it.
It was an animation. I mean, it might just be Pixar, but like, Yes. So there you go.
So we, you know, you want that best version of the script as you possibly can to go on the screen, and then you get it up on Reels. And like Brad's saying, instead of waiting 6 months, we're doing that in like 45 days. So that gap in, okay, we need to go in rewrites. Now you can get to it quicker. It hasn't been 6 months since you've been on the project. You know, would love to have the writer there on set on stage. That would be amazing. And that's what we did. We got the reels up. The third act wasn't working. We were missing an incredibly vital part of the story that exists now. And I went in and rewrote, and then we reshot the third act, and it is what you see today. So all I was sort of saying is, like, you know, you want to get to a point where this is what we're going to shoot. We feel really good about this. Let's see how it plays on Reels. And we don't want to wait 6 months to get to, let's see how we play on Reels. We want to get up on Reels as quickly as possible so that we can go back in and go, all right, this red, you know, you guys know, oh my God, this reads great. And you get up on Reels, you're like, what the fuck happened?
That's always
this
a fun
was
time.
So good. And then you realize, like, oh, it actually really wasn't. It read well because of the way you're sort of visualizing, but there are problems. You're now like creating problems here in the third act that you have to go back and fix in the first act or whatever it is.
Can you tell us what the third act change was? Just to teach, you know, we have a lot of emerging writers on here. We always want to talk story and craft too.
Absolutely.
Can you tell us what you had versus where you got?
Yeah, it was the dumbest thing. We didn't have the two soldiers fighting. They weren't fighting, trying to kill each other in the third act. And we got it up. They were still in the trenches. And it was when I wrote the script, it was really focused about this moment of Icarus flying back to the battlefield, and they both see what's going on. And then I think Abel, who's the guy on the right side of the screen, who's the kind of the rounder guy, he was commanded to shoot down Icarus. And then he shoots him down, and then Winston comes out, picks up Icarus and sees the message. And we saw it, and we were flat. It was terrible. It's like, this is awful.
And there's likability problems. There were a lot of problems.
And then so that's when we bring in our brain trust. We had Alan Barilero in there, Fergal Riley, you know, my editor on Lou. We had Tony Greenberg in there, Steve Hunter. Like, we had a bunch of great people come in. And these people were really important because these were all friends of ours. And we knew they were going to come in and not try and push their version of our film on us. They knew us well enough. They go, we know what you're trying to make. Let us help us try and make your version of the film. It was actually Fergal Riley who said, guys, you got to have the soldiers fight, you know, promise the premise. Like, and it's like one of those V8 moments where you're like, I am so fucking stupid, but you know, you're in the forest and you can't see it. And that's why you need that brain trust to come in and like really see with fresh eyes. And for any director or writer who gets insecure about that, please do not. That is one of the most important parts of creating anything, is having people that can come in and help you, because you are going to get so stuck in it and so in the minutiae of it that it's hard to zoom out. And when Fergal said that, when Alan and those guys came in with these great notes, the film just boop, 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 it got better. And so we reshot the third act, and it's what it is now. And it was what we intended. It wasn't what we were executing in the first pass. And so to say it's locked, meaning it was locked for that, you know, us going to stage, we went back and rewrote. And, you know, writers rewriting, constantly doing until you run out of time and you can't rewrite it. That's what it is.
I also find that the things that we had to change, like, that seemed like really big problems, those things turned out to be some of the strongest elements of the film. And I find that with songwriting and music too, like, that it's almost like a superstitious thing. I feel like when I confront a big problem with a creative process, it's almost like the universe is just testing you to see if you have the will to just keep working on it. Because if you push through that point, usually it's like the greatest reward. So I found that with this film, that really happened with a couple of things, like the third act and where the song actually plays in the film. Yeah. So I find that, I mean, if there are younger writers here and stuff, I find that as an artist personally, that I've noticed my entire life, that there's these moments of where you feel like all is lost, or your little hero's journey of the creative process.
It is.
You have the will to just keep pushing through that moment, that's usually when you get the greatest reward.
Oh, and you're talking to me today. This is where I was this morning with my writing. So thank you. I needed to hear it again.
Well, doesn't that happen like that? It seems
does,
uncanny.
But you forget every time you go back down into the cards, house of cards falling, you have dust in your hands, whatever. You forget. Like, I just, this is the moment. This is the moment to keep going. Yes.
Go ahead, Dave. Start over.
I was just going to say, it's funny too, because the biggest problem on this film and the whole reason why we were doing this film was the song. And how do you set the song up? And with that shitty ending that we wrote, the song just didn't fit anywhere in the film. We couldn't find a place for it. And then once we fixed the problem with the third act, suddenly now we have the moment when the song can play, because what we've done with the audience is that we've made a really strong statement about what the cost of war is, hopefully from an emotional place, so you feel it. And then there's that silence, you know, Tom's score drops out and you see the realization on their face. And that's when the song comes in. And some of the best compliments I've had on the film is like, I completely forgot that the song was even going to be in the short. I did too.
And that's why it was so beautiful.
It was like a revelation. Yes. And then I had it was like nostalgia and relief and beauty. It was lovely.
Yeah, and that was a real struggle for me, because from my perspective, I'll tell just quickly what happened was, from the way I saw it, was we got along so well with this story, and I was so attached and actually very confident about it, because I'd shown the script to my girlfriend and she got choked up and she rarely cries. So I was like, we've really got something. And we had such a great creative process with coming up with Icarus and the chess story. And I personally feel like I got completely lost in just this story that we had. And then there was this moment when I first saw like the rough cuts with the song in it, with my parents' song in it. And what I felt was like, oh my God, I completely forgot to check to make sure that these visuals match. Like, just in terms of a pure editing, like, does this scene look nice with this music? And I hadn't thought of that, because I just was so excited about the meaning of the story. And so when that happened, I felt like another All Is Lost moment. I really did. I felt like I'd maybe was letting down my mom and dad. I mean, I felt really upset about it and terrified. And ultimately, we kept going back and forth. And, you know, the story that's famous among us is that I said, you know, I'd rather have the film be great than the film be compromised and we just shove the song in there and it kind of doesn't work. So even if we have to play the song at the end of the film in the credits, I said, if it works best, then we can do it that way. And that was sort of like my big, you know, All Is Lost kind of giving in, like I'm giving into this process. And frankly, again, not to over-dramatize, but when we finally found that the song could start on Icarus's, you know, moment, I'll say, I can't even say it. It's just because it's so sad. And then have it play, but then continue out to over the credits, that was like the best thing that happened to the film. And it really wouldn't have been great without that. But the film didn't have that the whole time we were working on it. We thought of it in another way. So I just think that's another amazing kind of hero's journey process of the creative process of this film. And it happened twice, with that ending not working and then also with the song not working. And for me, that was the biggest drama, because I felt like I had sort of done something that I'd led my parents' music astray. And so there was a big like crisis of confidence at that moment, and we really solved it. And it turned out to be my favorite thing about the film ultimately.
Well, and that's, I'll have to say with Sean, I've said this before in other interviews, but I feel like Sean was very brave during this whole process, because he could have at any point freaked out and said, what in the fuck are you guys doing? Why did I do this with you guys? And there were moments where we know he freaked out.
He did say it once.
yeah. He did freak out when he saw the first mocap edit. He freaked out a little bit, but he didn't freak out. I freaked out because
lowercase freak out.
It was a big freak out, but I knew that it was just me freaking out, because Brad had warned me. He said, look, we normally would never show a client this stage, but because you're part of the creative process, we're going to show it to you, but you have to be warned, this is going to be difficult to watch. And me thinking that I'm an artist and I draw as well, so I'm like, I know what sketches are like. I know what a demo is like. Like, don't worry about it. And then they showed me this literal horror show, like the most disturbing thing I've ever seen in my life, because I was already attached to the
was
the
it rough anim? Like, what did you guys show? Was it just blocking?
Really rough, uncleaned up mocap. Yeah,
the mocap. It was the mocap, like just the blocking, but they only had the one asset of Winston, the main character's face, with no expression, just like a dead evil mannequin. There was like every soldier was Winston, naked and bald. With like this evil look on his face. And then the pigeon was literally just like a football or like a rock. And so every time he would throw the he'd try to be like the scene when he would be like, fly, Icarus, fly. He would just kind of hold his hand up and the pigeon would just go up and then drop like a brick. And then he would just kind of stare into the distance. It felt like the zombie. Most, it was like an evil nightmare world. And I thought,
would you guys do that again? Or would you have maybe perhaps shown some screen grabs?
Well,
next
no,
time?
Listen, next time I will know. That's the thing. So you have to, it's like it was a trial by fire. And I don't think any explanation from Brad could have prepared me for it, because there's just something so disturbing about emotionless faces being repeated. Actually, what it reminds me of that is a famous scene from Being John Malkovich, when he goes into his own head and suddenly everyone is Malkovich. It was like that, but more terrifying because there's no facial expressions.
It was closed.
Just awful. It was awful.
But all that said, I still believe that like that Sean was brave in that, but to take, you know, one of the crown jewels of his mom and dad's catalog and entrust us with it. And, you know, when, especially when the song wasn't working in the short, like that was the moment to have a true freak out, because he is responsible for now carrying on that catalog and its legacy. So here we are, first trip out, you know, first time out with the mom and dad's car, and we're gonna crash it right into the brick wall. But he didn't. He was totally, you know, he kept his composure like we all did, but not having the experience in the animation process. I mean, I think it was exceptionally brave to just keep believing and trusting. I mean, there was
he's an artist.
I think all of you in this process have been really brave, right? And it shows in the work and it shows in the reward, right? Sean, with your parents' song and sort of committing to process, and the group, and Dave and Brad, you guys starting a new company and going with this new tech and experimenting and sort of putting yourself out there and making big, scary choices along the way creatively and professionally. Like, all of it feels like an extraordinary risk. And I think so much of that is in the film and in our experience of watching it. It feels bold and scary, and it's really emotional, and like you can feel it in there. So I don't really have a question. I just wanted to say that, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, if you have time, and you may not, we always end our show with three questions, very quick questions. If you guys have another 2 minutes, we can ask you the questions. Is that okay? Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
And we'll ask them, each of you will answer one question as we go. So the first question for all three of you to answer, I will ask, which is, what makes you happiest? What is your favorite thing about being an artist?
I can go first. Yeah, that's interesting, because it's pretty simple for me. I really, really enjoy having made something. I mean, it's such a high. And I, you know, it's almost probably on the verge of Pygmalion, meaning like you can get carried away where you're just like too excited about it. But that's why I make art, is because I really love the feeling of having completed something. And yeah. I think I would say almost nothing gives me a sense of kind of confidence and self-esteem and just a general sense of things are good in the world than having worked and completed something. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily even have to be art, but having spent the time and energy on achieving something and completing it, is an incredible that. Feeling. And I think there's nothing else like it in life, to be honest. So I do love that about the creative process and work in general.
Great.
For me, Dave? I would say it's the camaraderie. It's what we talked about earlier in the chemistry of this team. But, you know, look, we've all worked on films that we are not proud of. And I think it in those cases, it always goes back to the core of the people you're working with, that something's broken at a deeper level. And in my case, you know, I had an experience before this that led me to, that pushed me out off the ledge to jump, you know, without the parachute. And you know, for me, Dave and I talk about it, like, you know, you get older and you're at a point in your career where you start looking maybe at your career from the end back towards the middle, and you know, you've only got X amount of projects left. So I'm not going to waste them working on projects that A, I'm not invested in, and B, more importantly, you know, the root, I think, of happiness is human connection. And if you're not connecting with the people that you're working with every day, then it's, you probably shouldn't be doing it. So agreed. For me, that's it's the people in that process of the daily. Because at the look, I'm with Sean. I love creating something, but I've realized over the course of my career that the getting to the end isn't as rewarding for me as the process itself and the journey to get there.
Mm. Dave?
Yeah, I'm pretty much in line with both these guys. I think in the beginning of my career, you know, beginning of your career, you take a job, or I'll speak for myself. I took a job in the order of project, money, people. And the older I've gotten, it's people, because it's everything. Like, the only reason why we feel any level of success with this film is because Brad and Sean and I work so well together, and then the people that we brought on, you know, Electra League has a no assholes policy where I don't care how talented you are. If you are a dick, this isn't the place for you. Because this is so, filmmaking is so hard. It's so hard. Like, you have to be surrounded by people that are going to support it, because invariably in every film that we do, any project, I don't even care if you're just building shelves or whatever you're endeavoring in, you're going to hit a moment where it's so incredibly hard. You know, it's the, you know, dark heart of the night, it's the belly of the beast, whatever you want to call it. And it's brutal. And if you're not surrounded by people that you can figure it out with, that will be kind of kind in those moments, then it's going to be awful. Because it's like, it's really easy to be nice to people when things are going well, but when things are going bad, you have to have had that relationship of kindness where you go like, okay, this is hard. I've got some hard stuff. This isn't you. This is a process. We know it's going to happen. So for me, same thing. It's like, it's people. Yes. Like, that's the thing that makes me the happiest. Because I know if I'm surrounded with great people, the film's going to end up being great.
Amazing. Yeah. All right, Lorian.
All right, I get the second question was, is what pisses you off about being an artist? Dave, oh, that's God. Not your turn yet. Let Sean go.
How long do we have?
Yeah, just don't. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, I
yeah. Okay.
I mean, I'll be honest. But I also want to say it with the caveat that I know that there are much bigger problems that people can have in life.
Of course.
But I do feel like there was a time when there was more reverence for art and artists in the world. And I think that's especially true of music now, because of the way that the technology of streaming kind of was designed to diminish the value of the creators and sort of emphasize the value of the advertisers and the corporations. You know, I remember when I was young, you know, we used to think of the record labels as these kind of criminal businessmen who were ripping off the artists. And now we would kill for a deal like those deals that we considered a ripoff in the 90s and 80s in terms of, you know, the royalty. So I feel like that's a metaphor for what's happened to art in general. I mean, if you just look at the filmmaking landscape, there are a lot less quote unquote high art films in the theaters than there used to be. And, you know, not, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm criticizing people because, you know, there's still great filmmakers everywhere and amazing artists everywhere, but it just seems like as a society at large, we don't value those things. I mean, you know, the ballet houses are closing and the opera houses are closing. And it just seems like we've entered a phase of civilization where we don't appreciate artists in the same way. I mean, you look at the Renaissance when the artists were these really, really respected members of high society. And now, you know, they don't even want to teach art in public school anymore. So I feel like I really lament the downgrading and the degradation of art in our lives as a society at large. And I think it's, frankly, I think it's very damaging. And I think it's potentially dangerous because a classical education used to be math, science, language, and art and history, right? But art was in there with math and in there with history and language. The fact that we've sort of pushed art to the side and we consider it frivolous because all we care about is, I guess, right, money making, I think is really damaging to the world. And it's something I lament on a daily basis. So, yeah.
Agree.
I'm tempted to say something about the gatekeepers. Films are so expensive and how the gatekeepers sort of function and how they chase trends at times, but you know, we're all pissed off about that. And there's some great gatekeepers and some not great keepers. So that's just whatever. But just thinking that there's younger screenwriters or artists that are listening to this, I think the thing pisses me off the most about art is how I compare myself to people I admire. Yes. You know, watching a Kira Kurosawa film, watching Denis Villeneuve film, you know, reading books that I love, you know, it's so easy to compare yourself to those people, but you don't know what you as a person don't know what they've gone through. You're just looking at the tip of the iceberg of what they've created. And so it pisses me off when I compare myself to other people like that I admire, because it's not really fair to them and it's not really fair to me, because there's probably somebody, hopefully one day, maybe there'll be somebody that compares themselves to me and they feel the same way. And, you know, I just want to encourage people to say, like, don't get, be easy on yourself. This is hard. Yeah. And try not to, you know, if you're taking your first step, you shouldn't be running in the Olympics. So just take it easy on yourself. So that's what pisses me off about myself, is I don't always do that.
I love that. Brad?
I think for me, it's, you know, again, Dave touched on it, but the frustration, it's not so much the gatekeepers. It's people that have a say over art that make decisions based on fear. And they and I get it. I get why. I do. I get the art and commerce thing, but just so many times where I feel like the wrong decision gets made because it's somebody scared to take a chance. And I think you guys said it earlier. It's like in art, if you aren't taking chances and you aren't risking failure, then you aren't going to move people. And I feel like that's what happens a lot of times in filmmaking and, you know, in the movie industry, is that there's just a lot of stuff out there because people aren't willing to, you know, shoot the pigeon.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that poor pigeon.
It's the t-shirt. Shoot the pigeon, not all the
way. No, you need gatekeepers who are brave. The gatekeepers have to be brave too. Absolutely. All right. Last question. Go ahead, Jeff.
And just amazing answers across the board. Just, I feel like you all have summarized the entirety of how I've ever felt about art in these six responses. The last question we ask is, if you could go back and have a coffee with your younger self, what would you tell that version of yourself?
What advice? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I could give myself advice when I was younger, the main thing would be is to, and I think Dave would agree with me, we've spoken about this, is to just not let your ego get in the way of learning and growing from people around you who are experienced or might have, you know, ideas about how to improve your work. When I was younger, I was a lot more defensive, And I was a lot more confident, but it was a kind of false confidence because it was a confidence that was based on insecurity. And so my initial reaction to criticism was always to be like, well, you're wrong. So it prevented me from growing as fast as I could have grown. And now at this point, you know, at my age, I've made so many records and written so many songs, terrible and decent, both terrible and decent, that I've realized that and we say this actually, Dave and Brad and I have all said this, that, you know, no ideas are bad. Meaning,
yeah,
if anyone has any input or ideas for you, the worst that can happen is that you ultimately don't agree with that. The best that can happen is that they're right and you can make the piece of art better. So I think for me, the most important thing was overcoming that. And I do feel like I was lucky enough to overcome that fairly early on. But I remember making some records early in my life. And I remember specific conversations that wiser people than myself had given input on. And I just sort of rejected it outright because it made me feel uncomfortable. And that's just very destructive for the artistic process. And it's really, no one benefits from that. So I think that's one of the greatest things. If I could have done it earlier, I would have made that much more progress faster and made better work.
Great advice.
Yeah.
Brad?
I think for me, it would be trust your gut, because I feel like, and Sean and I have talked about this one, but I feel like I'm driven more by intuition and I'm like gut check guy. I wear my heart on my sleeve. And I think there are times where I second guess that in life. And look, you do what you do and you get where you get. And I feel like I've made my way, but I think there are probably, I think I could have made some of the same decisions earlier. I feel like I passed on these windows that open a couple times in my life that maybe I wish I wouldn't have. But I think it's really about trusting your gut. And I think everybody has that. I think, some people are more risk adverse to trusting that gut, but I really feel like it's very important in any creative endeavor.
Absolutely. And Dave?
Yeah, I completely agree with what both Sean and Brad said. I feel like probably, the ego thing for sure, like get that in check and just try and recognize when people are trying to help you. And also try and recognize when people aren't, because there is that in the world too. But when it's more likely that people are probably trying to help you. Just a quick story. When I directed Lou, I pitched films at Pixar Short Ideas for 7 years before I got a green light on Lou. And I had one of the story artists ask me one time, he's like, how'd you do it, man? How'd you get that green light? You pitched all those years? And I pitched once and like, I had three ideas they didn't like, and they said, fuck you guys, you don't know what you're talking about. And my response to that was, they didn't like those ideas for a reason. These are smart filmmakers, they're smart people, and if there's something they didn't like about it, then I need to go back to the drawing board and figure out a way to make it into something that people are going to like. So, early on, like try and put your ego aside, like Sean's saying, and try and listen to when people are helping you, even though the help comes in the form of, this isn't right.
Yes.
Now we've all experienced the people that are just doing that because of their ego. So you have to be able to discern it. But when people are, your real friends are going to tell you when something's wrong because they want to help you. So listen to that. That would be my advice.
What I love about all three of your answers, and it's so clear how connected you all are, they're variations on a very similar, like there's something at the bottom of it and you all have a different interpretation of it. It's like, I would give you like a pitch for a movie and you'd each come up with a different movie, but it's the same pitch, right? Same theme, same character, so it's really beautiful to see you guys working together, even on that very personal level as well. Like you said that at the beginning of the show, how you're also, personally connected. So it's interesting to listen to how you guys play off each other and have such similar.
And it's been just an incredibly insightful podcast to hear you guys and your thought process, not just about the movie and how it came together, but how you approach art, how you approach creativity, Let's make sure our listeners can watch this beautiful short. Where can they see it?
Right now, it's actually playing in about 700 theaters across the U.S. and Canada as part of the Oscar-nominated short film showcase. They're doing both the live-action shorts and the animated shorts. And in some cities, I think they're even doing the documentary shorts. But it's being run by Shorts TV, distributed through Magnolia Pictures. So if you go to shorts.tv, you can check your local area for theater times.
And if it changes as you go and you get another distributor, we'll definitely say that on the show as well and put it on our Facebook page so everybody can find you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you
for having us. Great. Thank you.
Honestly, it means so much coming from you guys. You're such pros, and I'm a big fan of your work. I mean, I know we're wrapping up, but just in terms of the subject that we had mentioned of how to challenge young audiences, but, you know, and how to sort of have that perfect balancing beam of keeping it, you know, of not dumbing it down or not being condescending, mm-hmm. but also and challenging young audiences while still working within studios who have their own standards of why they need to do things a certain way. It's a really interesting subject to me. And I really am a fan of the few people I see in the industry, especially with animated films, who are still managing to do that. And I think they stick out, and I don't even need to name them. But you can see when there are certain projects that are, I think, more successful because of it as well, but that dare to kind of treat kids as you know, potential adults. They're going to be adults one day, so they have to deal with you know, really profound subject matter like mortality and dealing with your emotions and your fears. And it's really interesting.
No, it's true, because at Pixar, it's funny that you never talk about kids at Pixar. You only talk about what you like and what we as even adults or parents or when we were kids. Yep. I think that artists such as the three of you, you have a childlike quality anyways, because you're an artist, right? So that is always in all movies what makes the artists laugh and have fun. But then it's so all that deep character stuff. It's funny, I asked once on Brave, bear scene was very scary for kids, and they looked at me like I was nuts. Like, what does that have to do with anything? thank you so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you so much for your time.
Bye, everyone.
Bye. See you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. See you.